chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them,
but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing. One of my favorite philosophers on love said in the late 1990s, "You know, I think there's a difference between like and love, because I like my Skechers, but I love my Prada backpack." Hi, Eliza.
But Janelle, I love my Skechers.
But Eliza, that's because you don't have a Prada backpack.
Oh, we're talking about one of our favorite movies this week.
Yeah, no notes. I have no commentary. This is the end of the episode. That's the whole tweet. Bye, everyone. See you next week.
Actually, for the next hour, we will just be discussing whether or not one can be whelmed.
I cannot wait to talk to you about this screenplay. I have been waiting since I saw this movie 24 hours ago to discuss with you in detail why this screenplay is the perfect teen rom-com screenplay. Great. Let's go.
It is so good. All right, let's jump into it. Janelle, give us a summary and then let's go, go, go.
Okay, here we go. I'm like literally about to cry saying it. We're talking about 10 Things I Hate About You, the year of our Lord, 1999, kicking off our month of 1999 classics. Woo. Here's your Google summary. Kat Stratford, played by Julia Stiles, is beautiful, smart, and quite abrasive to most of her fellow teens, meaning that she doesn't attract many boys. Oh, by the way, I forgot to say, this is my least favorite summary we've ever read on this show, and we will be discussing that. Ahem.
Great.
I continue. Unfortunately for her younger sister, Bianca, played by Larissa Olnick, house rules say that she can't date until Kat has a boyfriend, so strings are pulled to set the dour damsel up for a romance. Soon, Kat crosses paths with handsome new arrival Patrick Verona, played by Heath Ledger. Will Kat let her guard down enough to fall for the effortlessly charming Patrick? Well, Eliza, that is what Google erroneously says 10 Things I Hate About You is about, and it makes me very angry. What is it really about?
The thing they got the most right is that Patrick is effortlessly charming.
Ugh, I burn, I pine, I perish, Eliza.
I know, Janelle. We all do. All right, this movie. Okay, let's start with the basics, because I feel like we need to lay some groundwork. So, for those who don't know, 10 Things I Hate About You is a modern, at the time, interpretation of the Shakespeare play, The Taming of the Shrew. Now, this is where the warning comes in. Janelle and I are nerds, and it's gonna get nerdy up in here.
To add another layer to the nerdiness, my first play was an adaptation of Taming of the Shrew because I am obsessed with 10 Things I Hate About You. So it's gonna get real serious real fast. Hang on to your butterfly barrettes.
Yeah, so we're starting with, this is an adaptation. Much like Clueless, another movie adaptation that we talked about, which is also from the 90s, this takes a timeless literary classic and turns it into a 90s teen drama. And it does it really well.
Yeah, it's actually shocking because, listeners who are not as deep in the Shakespearean canon as Eliza and I are may not know that while Taming of the Shrew is an often produced Shakespearean classic in many ways, it's been adapted into many films, including very famously one with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. The plot is actually pretty complex. It's not the most complex of Shakespeare's comedies, but it does include a really strange sort of like meta plot container. There are three suitors for Bianca, and the whole thing gets a little bit complex in terms of fake identities and things of that nature. But what this movie does really well is it condenses the central plot elements down into this really consumable, simple plot that you can hang on to. And they do so, I think, quite brilliantly, Liza. I'm curious what you think about this, by making the suitors of Bianca, making them do a kind of classic 1990s rom-com bet plot.
No, I think they make a couple of decisions that modernize the story into a modern film language that also really clarify the story in a way that is lovely. I also want to point out that this play is a really great example of a your fave is problematic. This is not a play that necessarily easily translates to a modern voice because there's some real gender issues that are quite squicky. And that doesn't mean that it's necessarily bad, but it just is something that I think a lot of people who try to adapt it for the stage or the screen do have trouble with. And I really like the ways that they adapt those moments, because instead of just putting them bald-faced on the screen for you to see and then feel uncomfortable about, they turn them into discussion points about modern feminism.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the more brilliant strokes in this screenplay, is that by turning Katerina into Kat and making her go from this classic, if you're not familiar with the history of early modern English drama, which I assume many of you are not, the shrew as a kind of stage convention was very popular at the time. It was from the Middle Ages to the early modern period, it was very popular to have on stage as a sort of comedy convention this idea of a shrewish woman who would chase after a man and he would in turn sort of hit her. It's very much related to the sort of Punch and Judy puppet show, if you're familiar with that convention as well. But this film takes Katerina and takes her from being that shrew archetype into making her what at the time was a very popular archetype that was similar, right? The kind of feminist killjoy, the riot girl of the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I think by doing that, like you said, they prompt a really interesting conversation about feminism. And they also really subtly change the plot from we have to tame the shrew to how can all of these characters transform and be changed in order to be better lovers mm-hmm. to each other. And I think that that is a really powerful but subtle change as well.
Yeah, absolutely. She is not the only one who has to adjust her thinking or her actions over the course of the movie, which again, I think part of that is just sort of the natural progression of this being in a 90s teen movie language. You know, you already have that kind of trope expectation that like everyone's gonna learn a lesson because like it's a teen movie, and that doesn't always happen in a teen movie. Lord knows there's plenty where they don't really grow at all, but it's a pretty common convention. You know, and you have the character who doesn't, right? You have Joey, who's just the asshole character, and he's as much of an asshole at the end as he is at the beginning. But you know have the sort of two main couples, each, all four of them kind of have to learn things about each other and about themselves and how they interact. And so it's not just about taming the shrew. It's sort of about all of them taming each other and themselves.
Yeah, like I hadn't really noticed before how much Bianca gets shifted in the plot.
Bianca is great in this movie. I am such a fan of the character of Bianca, because it would have been so easy to keep her the airheaded bimbo, empty-headed popular girl that they introduce her as. They introduce her with what we introduced this episode with, the conversation about loving your Skechers or your Prada backpack. But she rather quickly, actually, faster I feel like than I remember it being, starts to have realizations about what she does and doesn't want in her interpersonal and social interactions.
Yeah, and I think you're right that in that way, that's what makes this film a sleeper kind of pop feminist hit, is that it's so much about not just Kat, but also Bianca navigating and coming into her own as a romantic and sexual actor and making these decisions for herself. What feels good to her, what fills her cup, so to speak, rather than what she thinks she should want, right? Which is sort of the Joey versus Cameron debate.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is funny. I do want to point out, I noticed this time around watching it, Cameron, who is the character played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who is the, you know, guy you're supposed to be rooting for Bianca to get together with, he, I think, grows the least and has to answer for his crimes the least in this movie.
Let's get real technical about screenwriting and playwriting right now. Here's why I think that is. I think that is because Cameron is our raisonneur. That's the technical term. He is our audience point, right? He is the place where we are supposed to identify. So because of that, we are not given enough space to criticize his behavior. Like, for example, why does he have to go in this roundabout way of getting Bianca? And why does Bianca never call him out on that?
That was the thing I wanted this time around, that I don't know, maybe I've had this thought before, but I hadn't felt as strongly in previous watchings. But in viewing it this time, I was like, you get to the end and Kat is furious at Patrick for having lied to her and, you know, taken her out under false pretenses and whatever. Yeah, sure, that's fine. And Bianca is pissed at Joey for having screwed around with her sister in an attempt to screw her, in an attempt to get back at her sister. And they're all sort of upset that this like thing happened, except that Cameron and his buddy Michael are the ones who came up with the idea and set it up in the first place. And I kind of wanted Bianca to make him answer for that. And he doesn't. He just gets the girl. And it's not that I don't want him to get the girl, but I did want her to be like, I can't believe you screwed with my sister's feelings like that just so you could go on a date with me.
Yeah, the most that she ever does is when they're working on their, you know, French homework or what have you, she yells at him for not asking her out yet, which is a, it stands out to me as one of the weird, odd moments in this film that doesn't sing perfectly, because literally every other beat in this film is like pitch perfect and the pacing is insanely good. But that one just doesn't, it doesn't ring true. And I think that you're right. It's because it doesn't feel like it's speaking to the truth of the situation. It's like, no, him not asking you out is not the problem currently.
Well, and one of the really enjoyable things about this movie is the budding friendship between Cameron and Michael and Patrick, because it is so sort of weird and strange. But like, Patrick gives him a pep talk, and, you know, he and Michael come into it when they realize that the shit hath hitteth the fan if at the end, you know, and it's they're all sort of looking out for each other. And they've got this kind of like, you know, bros look after bros situation that's kind of lovely, because they are this sort of weird trio of friends. So you're rooting for him and you're wanting to see him grow and develop. But like, he does not grow and develop in relationship to the women in a way that I don't think is true of the other guys.
Yeah, and I think that as you're talking about this, it's making me think about the timing of this film. Like, you know, this month we're talking about the year 1999, and as some of you who listen to the podcast regularly know, this is a period of good fascination for me and Eliza, because it's what I like to call the great crisis of masculinity around the turn of the millennium. And I wonder if, in addition to being our raisonneur, our audience surrogate character, Cameron also in some ways is a teen representative of this insecure masculinity that is going to become a major problem when it hits internet culture in the mid-2000s, just a few years after this, which is this kind of entitled, not quite an incel, but with some incel-ish like seeds, this idea that women are yours to take, that they owe you something for your friendship, these kind of things, which at times he is implying, I think.
Yeah, and it definitely, you're right, it doesn't cross over into that incel territory, but it's got a lot of the hallmarks of the early aspects of that. And I think watching it now, that stands out even more, because I think we were set up to believe that that was more, those are the kind of things that would be true of the Heath Ledger character, of Patrick, and they're just not. With the exception of the fact that he does accept this money from this guy to take this girl out, which, like, ethically not a great slate, but he doesn't even know her at this point. He's like, I don't know why I'm getting thrown into this, but I might as well make some money. He's an idiot teenager. Like, okay, fine. With the exception of that, he's genuinely very kind-hearted through the entire movie.
Yeah, can we talk about the fact that he holds back from kissing Kat after Bogey Lowenstein's party, not because he doesn't want to, but because of two things I read in that moment. One, the bet plot. He doesn't want to take advantage of her because of the bet plot. And two, he doesn't want to take advantage of her because she's drunk.
And what's really lovely about that is that it's not even, I feel like a less nuanced movie would have had that almost kiss happen in the previous scene when they're still at the party and he's just walked her out. You know, and it would have had, you know, she's so drunk and he's talking her through not falling asleep because she might have a concussion, and then they almost kiss and then she like barfs on his shoes. But they don't have an almost kiss there. They're just talking. And then later, when you're supposed to understand that he has like made sure she's okay, probably gotten her some water, gotten her into the car, driven her home, and the two of them, she's conscious enough to be able to have a full conversation with him about each other, about their insecurities, about all of this. But he still knows that she is not of sound mind, that she has had a really hard night, that she is alcoholically compromised, but also emotionally compromised. And he chooses not to take advantage of that. And then she's frustrated with him the next day, but he does not, you know, indicate that he regrets what he did. And I really appreciate that they wrote that in, because so many other movies would not have done it that way.
Again, we go back to kind of what it does in terms of its adaptation. In Taming of the Shrew, Petruchio, the Patrick equivalent, is a dick. He's the worst. And that's sort of the joke, is that he is a male shrew in many ways. However, in the end of the play, he still gets to tame Katerina, however you want to interpret the last several stanzas of the play. We can't even get into that, because no one who listens to this podcast, with the exception of like 10 people, are as nerdy as we are about the various interpretations of that ending, and so we will leave it at that. But at any rate, in this version of it, the Petruchio character is not interested in taming Caterina at all. He appears to be what Petruchio is in the play, but in actuality, he's something else. He's something more complicated and more nuanced, just like Cat is.
Right. Like that's the thing, is that a lot of this play is about what the, you know, expectation is of someone, right? What their label is, what their trope is, what everyone says they are versus what they actually are once you get under the surface. And I feel like that translates so well to this 90s teen setting, because, you know, it starts right off, right, with being like, here's everyone's trope. Here's your, you know, bimbo popular girl. Here's your, you know, 80s teen movie bad guy type. Here's your, you know, angry feminist chick, right? Like it gives you all of these right away, and it does it in a very not subtle way, in a way that now we have seen happen in many teen movies, which is the new kid comes to the school and the person touring them around points out all of the different tables at lunch, right? Like it literally has a Mean Girls opening where he's like, there are the popular kids and there are the business bros and there are the burnouts, right? Like it does the whole thing. You get this in Clueless, you get this in so many teen movies, and I feel like this is one of the early ones that did it, but it works so well for the setup of the main characters as well.
Well, and I'd like to point out that there are many questions I have about Gabrielle Union's character in this film, Chastity, but we will get to that. Mm-hmm. But I will say that scene where they're walking through the tropes, as you said, really made me reflect on Mean Girls. Because mm-hmm. now that we've all had enough hindsight, about 15 years of hindsight on Mean Girls, we can all acknowledge that scene in the cafeteria is pretty racist. And it was interesting to me to see that scene play out in 10 Things I Hate About You and see that there are actually some like anti-racist things going on in there. Like the whiteness of the white Rastas gets called out pretty hard, not just once, but several times as the butt mm-hmm. of jokes. And not just by the white characters, but also by Mr. Morgan, who's a black character, a black actor, right? Mm-hmm. So it really made me think about race in this movie too. I mean, it's more or less absent in those references to the white Rastas. But in that way, it is sort of doing something better than Mean Girls did 6 years later. So it really speaks to you about what a weird time 1999 was. Like, there are a lot of backwards things that happened, but there were also these pockets of sort of forward thinking that we would move backward on.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think in this movie, and I'll be curious to see as we watch some of the other 1999 movies this month, if we run across this again, because we've certainly seen it in some of the other just like broadly 90s movies we've come across. This thing where there is an acknowledgement of race and of the whiteness of the film while still maintaining the whiteness of the film, right? Like we have these jokes about these white Rastas over and over again. And the only black teen character is this best friend of the B plot girl who is fairly insignificant in her effect on the plot. Then the only other black character we have is Mr. Morgan, this English teacher, who I would love to talk about for a moment, because he gets two or three moments where he gets to call out how white everyone is by calling out the white Rastas, by, you know, clapping back at Kat. And then he gets this cool moment where he gets to rap Shakespeare to show that it's neat and modern and funky. And it's like, every time I watch it, that moment becomes like a little more painful.
How do I want to even describe this? It's sort of a, I would say, a media parasite that has attached itself to this movie from the teacher comes to the inner city school to get the kids to care about writing movies that came about in this period as well. There were probably like 5 or 6 of them that were like this. And I just, every time I see that scene, I just think, oh, no, you didn't need to make that reference.
The other thing with Mr. Morgan, the black teacher, is that one of our early introductions to Kat, she's in the classroom and they have just had to do a reading from a Hemingway book. And before they can even discuss the reading, she launches into a diatribe about the fact that all of their books in this English class are written by, you know, white American or European men, and that there's more interesting viewpoints out there, and she lists several authors, and of course they have her list, you know, Sylvia Plath and that kind of thing, because you have to understand who her type is. But right. All of the points she's making I think are extremely valid, and I would love to at some point wax poetic about my thoughts on how we form English literature curriculums in this country. But then Mr. Morgan, instead of saying, you may have some good points, and I would like to expand on that, says, shut up, we don't need to hear from white women, we need to hear from black men. And I immediately was like, wow, I guess this movie was written before intersectionalism existed.
It is very interesting to think about that because, background, the term intersectionality is traced back primarily, though not exclusively, because that idea was floating around for a very long time already in black feminist circles in the 60s and 70s. But academically, it's traced back to the work of Kimberly Crenshaw. 1991, I believe, is the year this essay came out, Demarginalizing the Intersection of Sex and Race. And in that essay, Crenshaw is centering black women as her case study for what she's mm-hmm. talking about in terms of intersectionality, of course. And in that, what she points out is that because black women are multiply burdened by race and gender, black men and white women have actually more similar positions in society than we mm-hmm. would like to admit. They are not exactly the same, of course, because all intersectional identities are mutually constitutive and they are very specific, but they have a similar level of privilege, right? They are sort of burdened on the basis of one aspect of their identity in a serious mm-hmm. way. Otherwise, they have access to complete privilege. So it's a really interesting case study of intersectionality, I think, that shows exactly what you're saying, that without the introduction of that term into the culture, which it had not gotten to the mainstream yet, but without right. the introduction of that term, of course, the scene is going to think like, these two characters have to be butting heads. And I have so many thoughts about that because I write about this in my dissertation about the relationship between men of color and white women in media. There's a lot there. I will hold it in. But yes, it's a very rich but small and moment and evocative of its time.
I was enjoying that, what you just shared so much. Thank you for that. And I just, yeah, when I was watching the scene, I just was like, it's written so that you're supposed to be listening to Kat and being like, oh, I get it. She's an angry feminist. But like, yeah, down with men. And then she gets shut down by the teacher. And it's written to be this like, oh, snap moment. And instead I was just like, no, but she made so many good points. And now we've fully glossed over them. And right. he's Both obviously making incredible points, but that get lost in the fact that he just like called out this white chick. Right. And I was like, but really, you're both right. And like, we need to read so much less Hemingway in the classroom.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think that that's another place where we could criticize the film is that while it is putting Kat forward as this like angry feminist who's like kind of a cool anti-hero, at least when I was younger, of course, I imprinted on her as exactly the kind of woman I wanted to be, right? But now looking back at it, I can see what you're saying, that there are points in the film where they kind of put her down at various points, especially her beliefs, the extremity of her beliefs. And it's interesting because on the one hand, I think like, well, in some ways that's good because we shouldn't just have this like perfect Mary Sue feminist character who's right about everything, mm-hmm. who's smarter than everyone, who's going to Sarah Lawrence, etc. But on the other hand, I think you're right. It's like the moments where they do criticize her, it is important to think about the specificity of the criticism. And that's a moment where you think, yeah, the moments where she actually gets to talk about her primary political beliefs are the ones where she gets smacked.
Yeah, basically the movie in the end, and this is an oversimplification, but the movie in the end is like, it's okay for her to be into angry girl indie music, but maybe she should stop ranting about angry girl books. And I just feel like that's not a great message to take away. You know, there's a whole joke about the feminine mystique, which is a very funny joke because he teases her about it and then she ends their argument by tossing the book into his arms. Like, it's well choreographed from a film standpoint, but like the joke is still ha ha ha, like anyone would want to read this book.
Which, I mean, okay, go read The Feminine Mystique. It's like really, really good and it's not hard to read. But they shy away from some of the more serious aspects of what feminism was in this period. Kat never talks about, she only really talks about the like resenting men because Joey sucks, and we should probably talk about that next. But she never talks about the feminist politics around sexuality and dating that really matter, right? Which is like intimacy, which is about respect, which is about like equal partnership, which is about, you know, access to birth control and reproductive justice, you know, the things that like really, really matter on a real level to feminists. She never talks about that. And of course, it's a teen movie, so maybe she shouldn't. But I think there could have been more.
We're nitpicking, right? Like, in the end, I do think she's a great character. And I think they do allow her to still be herself in the end, which is really lovely. But we are constantly confronted with these ideas of women as sexual objects, women as men's playthings, women as ticking time bombs that can get pregnant at any moment, right? All these kind of things that are presented to us because of the character of Joey and the character of Mr. Stratford, of their father. But while these ideas are being shoved in our face, the movie doesn't really address them. It circumvents them in a lot of ways.
Right. Like, I think about that scene, for example, where their dad, the Baptista Manola character, when he's talking to them about how he delivered a baby to a 15-year-old girl, and if she weren't so doped up, she would have said, "I should have listened to my father," which, one, is some patriarchal bullshit, and two, was a really prime opportunity for Kat's character to correct Bianca when Bianca says, "I should have asked my crackhead boyfriend to wear a condom." There's just, like, so much wrapped up in that phrase that I would imagine Kat in real life would have a lot to be like, let's sit and unpack that about access to reproductive justice and, you know, how we judge people with substance abuse problems and people who have access to different resources mm-hmm. than we have because we're privileged. But it's an interesting thing to think about how much of that was avoiding feminist politics and how much of it was pointedly representing Kat as a very privileged white upper middle class feminist.
Absolutely. Honestly, that one sentence of Bianca's, I feel like there is so much there. We could probably just dissect that moment in that scene for the rest of this episode, right? Because there's also, I think, something really refreshing in some ways about parts of that answer, because she, who is the youngest character in the film and, you know, sort of made to be the one who potentially is the most innocent, doesn't realize the men are playing her, whatever. In that line, we understand that she understands about sex. She understands about consent. She understands about safe sex and condom usage, right? Like, and clearly her father has given them these lectures before, so it's not shocking that she would know, like, how to use a condom, or that one should. But to have this character who's only 15 or 16 and has already been sort of shown to be the, you know, the ticking time bomb, right? The, like, will this guy get to sleep with her, and have her be like, excuse me, no one's sleeping with me without my permission, and they're certainly not doing so without a condom, I think is a really fascinating thing, because, again, we're talking about 1999 here, right? Like, this kind of stuff is obviously in the cultural conversation, but it's not unusual still for it to be glossed over. And this movie's like, look, we know what we're talking about. We know you know what we're talking about. We're going to put it out there. It's so complex because I think it is doing good things at the same time that it's doing bad things.
And it makes me think, too, about how they portray Kat's sex with Joey, where, you know, Bianca has, she doesn't really show a lot of interest in sex per se. She's interested in boys, definitely. Mm-hmm. Romance, for sure. But Kat shows an interest about sexuality in this earlier part. They connect it to her mom leaving, which I don't love, but it makes mm-hmm. sense from a character standpoint. We should talk about that too. But I appreciate that what they show is not Kat being embarrassed that she had sex with Joey, not being feeling shameful about it, but instead just deciding, like, hey, I did that. I wanted to see what it was about. And I, you know, told him I didn't want to do it anymore. And it's interesting because you can interpret the way that that plays out two ways. Either it's that she didn't want to do it anymore and he made her feel bad about that, so that's why she decided not to do things just because other people were doing them. Or she decided not to do things just because other people were doing them because she felt like she was pressured into having sex. And I don't know, like, both representations are kind of intriguing and not typical of how sex and teen sexuality shows up in these movies of this era.
Yeah, it definitely is interesting the way that they tie her first experiences with sex to her trauma, which is, you know, as we've discussed so many times, I don't love the trope of, like, the teenagers did bad things because their mom died or their dad left, or it's like, you know, sometimes, like, people just do things in life and sometimes mm-hmm. they end well and sometimes they end poorly. Sometimes people make bad decisions because they're 15. She does have this fairly healthy response in the end. And obviously we don't know what she was like when she was in ninth grade and went through this and how well she handled it at the time. But now, several years later, talking to her sister about it, she seems to have reached a place where she internally feels quite healthy about the decision. Mm-hmm. And it leads to one of my favorite scenes in the movie, because the discussion between the two sisters just rings very truthful to me. I find it to be a very realistic sister relationship that's portrayed. It's a really lovely moment. You really get a sense of their different ages and of the different ways that they have responded to their mom leaving, being stuck with their dad, the pressure of being the big sister, the little sister, you know. And I think that we don't get a lot of portrayals of women discussing sexuality in that kind of way. But I think that's so sort of normal, right? Like, if you've got a sister, you're going to talk to her about this stuff at some point. If you've, you know, right? Like, it is a really refreshing scene to see. And I don't think it passes a judgment on either sister and on their opinions in that moment. You know, they let Bianca be angry at Kat, but they also let Kat stand firm for her opinions in that moment, and it's really great.
Yeah, I agree. I really appreciate the relationship between Bianca and Kat, because in the play, they are just adversarial. The play begins with Katarina like tying Bianca up and terrorizing her. So it's really nice to see in this film that they've given them something more realistic in terms of their relationship. And I love that in the film, they can talk smack about each other, but when it really comes down to it, they come through for each other. You know, when Bianca really wants to go to Bogey Lowenstein's party, Kat does it because she asks, like, and she means it. And Bianca punches Joey in the face for Kat.
Also, side note, as you were saying that, I'm reminded just how much sort of physical torture there is amongst the characters in the original text.
Woo!
There's like a lot of tying each other up, a lot of spanking, a lot of, you know, all this kind of stuff. And obviously, like, that does not make it into this. But I almost wonder, this movie has a lot of weird background pain that occurs. There's a lot of moments of someone like throwing something off screen and then hearing someone yelp as they're hit with it, and like someone like tumbling down a hill because they're pushed out of the way. And I almost wonder if somewhere subconsciously, as they were making this screenplay, they were like, well, we don't have all of the like uncomfortable physical comedy of like the men spanking the women and the women tying each other up, so like, let's just have her accidentally shoot the gym teacher in the butt with an arrow.
Well, I think in general, I mean, part of the reason why I'm so impressed by the screenplay and the direction in this film is that it is one of the tightest teen comedies I've ever seen. Like, there is no dead air in this movie. It is absolutely incredible. It goes bit to bit to bit to bit to bit. If they have a beat, there's a joke, or there's character growth, or there is some sort of physical comedy thing happening. It's really, really an impressive example of great comedy filmmaking. And I think part of that, like you said, is that the film has a lot of slapstick comedy, not just in the foreground, but also in the background. And it makes me think about, there's a really important theater historian named Marvin Carlson, and he has this book called The Haunted Stage, where he proposes a theory that theater is full of hauntings, right? It's full of these sort of memories that the plays themselves carry, but also the audiences carry with them. And I think, to your point, Eliza, that's really what's happening here, is that this is an adaptation, consciously, of course, but it also carries with it this sort of cultural memory of hundreds of years of slapstick tradition, because of course the shrew trope is a base foundational slapstick comedy trope in English comedy. I mean, and so that really carries through beautifully, whether or not it's conscious. It's definitely, like you said, haunting this movie.
Well, and maybe it's even broader than that, but on that same level, just an element of understanding that a Shakespeare has to be comedic. And not just the plot and like the main characters have comedic moments, but just like inherently it is a comedic piece of performance. And in that, you know, Shakespearean definition of comedy, it's both that it has a happy ending, because otherwise it's a tragedy. But also that you can just put in jokes because you need jokes there, right? Like, if you're at a certain point where you're like, haven't made a penis joke in a while, time to just like have one of the servants come out and make a penis joke, because the audience is going to want to come and laugh at a penis joke. And so this movie sort of does that with like, oh, this was kind of a serious scene, so like, let's have them throw something at someone off screen and have them shout, and like, that'll be a great way to break the tension.
And of course, you know, you have some of our great American and Australian screen actors getting their major debuts in this film, so it makes sense. I mean, this cast is unreal. Julia Stiles, Heath Ledger, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I mean, Allison Janney? What?
I mean, David Krumholtz is one of those people who, when you go back and look at his list of credits, you're like, he is in so many funny movies from my childhood that I just like never even thought about, because for so long he was one of those like, oh, it's that guy type of actors.
Right.
And then you're like, he has been making me laugh since he was like 11 years old. And he's so funny, and he's so smart, and he like knows what he's doing, and he's got the comedy chops to pull off a part like this and make it endearing, even though his character like should not be endearing.
Can we talk about what really matters here, Eliza?
What really matters, Janelle?
Can we talk about Heath Ledger?
Let's talk about Heath Ledger.
Oh, I could cry. I can't. You start. It's too emotional, actually.
He is so lovely in this movie. And I feel like it's not an exaggeration to say that this is really what propelled him into stardom range. So he had been around for a while at this point. He'd been in some TV series, but most of them Australian. And I believe this was his first big American movie. And, like, what an entrance to make. He follows this up immediately with The Patriot and then A Knight's Tale in 2000 and 2001, right? Like, clearly the second he got on the scene, Hollywood just, like, grabbed him up again and again and again. But, like, in The Patriot, he is a main character but not a lead. He's definitely a B-plot character. And then in A Knight's Tale, he gets another lead role that is in many ways quite similar to 10 Things I Hate About You, just in, like, knight's clothing, kind of. kind of. But, like, he comes onto the scene and he is just immediately shown to be this, like, charming, suave, slightly badass, but, like, respects women and gives his friends pep talks and makes funny quips and he gets the comedic timing down and he's just like, you can't take your eyes off of him.
It's actually like, it's weirdly hard for me to talk about this because I fell in love with him watching this movie as a child. And I have never stopped being in love with him, even after he died. Even 13 years later, seeing him in this movie makes me so emotional because as an actor, he's just beautiful. I mean, you could see these close-ups of his face and the small, sensitive gestures of his face in this movie are incredible. And, you know, of course, that's about attractiveness in a sense. It's about his eyes. It's about his dimples. It's about his smile. But there's also just a real intelligence, like an emotional intelligence and sensitivity to how he was as an actor that where you can see in this movie, even though he's so young in it, I think he's 19 or 20 when they film this, you can see the depth of emotion that he's going to bring later to things like Brokeback Mountain and The Dark Knight. It is such a beautiful thing to see and to have in a bit of a time capsule, but it also breaks my heart a little bit too.
Absolutely. I mean, talk about someone who just had so much potential and obviously in many ways saw that potential, but it does make you sort of think like, God, what would he be doing now if he were still around? But it's just, he really does have that emotional intelligence that pops off the screen. And I think when you were saying earlier, there's that scene where he doesn't kiss her in the car and you can tell that it's partly because she's drunk, but also partly because of the bet is holding him back. And like, that is not scripted in there, right? Like, there's not dialogue to tell you that, but you can see it all happening on his face. You can see him going through the thought process of wanting to kiss her, knowing he shouldn't, thinking maybe he could anyway, pulling himself back. You know, there's all of these moments that have these subtleties that you really need for a character like Patrick or Petruchio to fill in the gaps left by the otherwise slightly icky plot structure, you know, right? Like if you've got this thing where he has to tame the shrew, but you show him feeling some way about it. You show him falling for her. You show him being tamed himself. You show him realizing she doesn't need to be tamed. And you can do a lot of that without dialogue, but only if you're incredibly talented.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what works about their dynamic and what makes it kind of persist today as a classic on-screen pairing is that you see every one of those subtleties. You know, if on the page, this character could be someone that we would be really kind of afraid for Kat, right? He's got this dangerous background. He smokes. He hangs out in biker bars. He, like you said, he agrees to take this bet, period. Like, maybe she should be afraid of him. But the moment where they are talking outside of her car and he says to her, "You're not afraid of me, are you?" That moment, it has like 3 or 4 levels of emotional resonance because he is attracted to it. He is fulfilled by it in a sense. Like, we can see the part of him that is still like a mischievous little boy respond to that feeling, you know? And in that moment, he stops being this sort of threatening bad boy. And instead, he becomes this complex, emotional person who kind of just needs one person to see him as a human being. Like, how is he getting that out of a 1999 teen rom-com script? And yet, bam, there it is.
Absolutely. And I mean, they do give him beautiful things to work with. One of the great revelatory moments is quite deep into the movie when he finally admits to Kat that the reason he wasn't in school the last year was because his grandfather was sick and he went and lived on his couch for a year taking care of him. And it's this thing that's been built up. Everyone's been saying their theories about, you know, he was in porn, he did this, he blah, 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 he was in jail. And he doesn't, when she first asks about it, give an answer, but the script is written in a way that you kind of don't realize he hasn't answered it. And then when he finally feels emotionally comfortable being vulnerable with her, he tells her that he spent a year caring for his sick grandfather. You know, and it's just this really lovely moment. And to have a very sort of understated, quiet moment like that in a script like this, that's also full of all of these like high school hijinks. What a gift for an actor.
Yeah. And I'm like getting emotional thinking about it, too, because it's also this like pointed moment of getting to see a very masculine character at this time of great crisis for masculinity, as we've discussed. The same year that Fight Club comes out, right? Have this moment of emotional vulnerability that is like lighthearted and it's not embarrassing. I mean, he's mm-hmm. throwing her around a dance floor when he does it. You know, yeah. Like it's just so beautiful. And like, there's also, I know I'm such a sap. I love him so much.
Guys, this is what the arts can do.
Oh, God. The one moment where he lashes out at her is because he is scared that she is going to find mm-hmm. out that he is not as good a person as he wants to be. And we, again, get that from his performance. And all of those things wrapped up in this character that is supposed to just be like an easy bad boy, James Dean type. I mean, what a gift to have that, not just in this movie in general, but at this particular time for the culture. Like, I get it. Like, I'm a sucker for a bad boy with a heart of gold. I am, because of this movie.
Right, like, this movie did this to us.
It did. Okay, there is no Jess Mariano without Patrick Verona. Okay, oh, let's be very clear. Very clear.
Wow, I feel like I just had, like, a whole, like, religious experience revelation in that moment. Thank you for putting those two things together in my mind, Janelle. I do love the bad boy who everyone's scared of, except if you talk to him, he's just a mushy teddy bear with a lot of thoughts. You know, we still haven't really talked about Joey.
Oh, God damn it, Joey.
Fucking Joey. He is certainly the most, like, 90s archetypal character that appears, but he's so much fun. Like, shout out to the actor who plays him. A shout out to Andrew Keegan, who, like, is playing this very one-dimensional character, but so well.
This cast, even the bit players, are unbelievably sharp, and he is magnificent. I mean, he makes you hate this dude. Hate. It's perfect.
The moment where he is watching Bianca walk away and then looks into his mirror and gives himself a little wink. my soul dies.
They really smartly took the suitors of Bianca, who were, it's Hortensio, Gremio, and Lucentio, who are the suitors of Bianca. And in this case, we only really have two suitors, but instead of making them all like more or less even keeled, they really were smart to kind of allow the suitors to take on these different high school archetypes. Another really smart shift in that translation.
One of the things that they do as well, and this takes us back to that character of Michael again, he's sort of the one controlling the machinations. He's not one of Bianca's suitors, right? Like, he's in it for Cameron, his new friend. He wants Cameron to win over Bianca. And he's sort of, I think, just having fun playing with the pieces on the chessboard as well. But in so many of the bet plots, the person who sets it into motion is the obnoxious friend of the hot popular guy. Mm-hmm. And you get a brief moment of that. There's a moment where one of Joey's friends is like, oh, what do you want to bet that you can't take Bianca out? But like, that's not actually what sets it into motion, because he says, no, I don't need the money, and like ignores him. It's Cameron and Michael who come to him with this idea of how to, like, you know, play around all these pieces so that he can get permission to take out Bianca. But by doing that, we end up with the person who's controlling it being someone who we come to like by the end of the movie, if not have liked the whole time. And it's someone who also gets to show compassion for the characters, right? Like, again, he's the one who sort of realizes shit's going down at the prom and, like, alerts everyone so that they can deal with it. He, you know, comes to fall for Mandela and is kind to her, and they bond over their Shakespeare love, you know, right? Like,
oh gosh, you're so right on every point, Eliza. Like, it is such an original riff on that bet plot, and I wonder if even them writing in that line from from Joey's best friend as a way to be like, no, 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 listen, we're not She's All That. We're going to do something slightly different. Which right. is actually kind of funny because She's All That came out just a couple months before this.
Yeah, and yet they're so similar in that aspect of the story.
That's what we like to call cultural confluence.
Right. Like, what was it about 1999 that made all of these people want to make teen movies where a guy got bet that he couldn't take a girl out?
There were a lot of teen Shakespeare adaptations that came out around this time as well. There was another one called Get Over It, which was a Midsommar adaptation.
Right. Like, there's all of these sort of, let's either make a comedic or an edgy, modern, often teen interpretation of Shakespeare. So something was in the air. I do think there was a real focus on high schoolers culturally. I think that truly the multimedia's understanding of the power of the teen consumer hits its like its zenith in the 90s.
Can we just take a brief moment to acknowledge, because this might actually be the most beloved movie of both of ours that we have talked about. What does this movie mean to you?
I feel like so much of my understanding of good storytelling came from the movies I was obsessed with as a kid and a young teenager. I am a very visual learner, and there's a reason that I went into theater and film and TV as my area of interest, because I really enjoy that kind of storytelling in a way even that I don't necessarily enjoy like books. And this is one of those movies that I saw at a young age and I've watched a million times and I enjoy every time. And I am someone who's very drawn to comedy, and I think that I just am that way naturally. But I also think movies like this helped to shape that. Because the comedy in this is so funny, so tight, so well done, and serves the plot so well and balances out those serious moments so beautifully that I so admire anyone who can create something like this.
I genuinely don't think I would be the person I am today without this movie. And that sounds like such an exaggeration. But if you see this movie and you know me well, it just has all of these little pinpricks of what would later become my personality. Like so much of Kat, so much of Patrick, so much of the influences in this movie, 90s punk rock, Shakespeare. I mean, just so much about it is me. And it gave me...
This movie is your aesthetic.
It is my aesthetic, like perfectly. It gave me the rough outline for the person I wanted to be. I mean, I literally, when I was applying to colleges, said, I want to go to an East Coast school because Kat Stratford said it. I changed my life because I wanted to be Kat Stratford. And, you know, I think as an adult woman now, I look back on that and think like, well, there are some things I disagree with Kat about, and that's okay. But I feel like every time I watch this movie, I tap back into that young girl who was trying to figure out who she was going to be, and that was this movie for me. And it still is.
Well, and I really feel like this movie gives its characters leeway to be those young people who are still figuring out who they want to be, right? Like this is one of those teen movies that really gets it right in that it allows its characters to grow, but it does not imply that this is the end of the journey. You know, so I think we are supposed to understand that Kat, like, some of her opinions are, you know, aren't finished molding themselves and aren't perfect and are going to continue to evolve with time. You know, Bianca's still quite young and she's still learning what she wants out of relationships and out of boys. And right, like they're all, this is definitely a happy for now, not necessarily happily ever after story. Yeah. And I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Like I think the last few lines of the movie are so magnificent for exactly that reason. Because Kat says to, you know, Patrick, after he buys her a guitar with all the money that he got for taking her out, she says, you know, every time I get mad at you, you can't just buy me a guitar and make it all better, which is a really good point. And he says, oh, well, you know, but if you're going to start a band, like, I'll have to get you a drum set and a tambourine. I mean, that's so beautiful because it's acknowledging that, like, no, things are not perfect between them. Like, they are clearly going to fight again. But they want to figure it out.
And isn't that what you want from a Taming of the Shrew? Like, there's so many ways you can take Taming of the Shrew to really, really dissect those gendered roles and the role that violence has within that. And I know that you, in your own work, have done some of that. But, like, in the end, if you want Shrew to be a comedy, what you need to take away from it is that people are changeable.
Yes.
Because it's the only thing that makes any part of it okay.
Yeah, which is a whole other podcast. Oh, man, could we talk for an hour about why Taming of the Shrew should never be produced again? Great. This is the time every episode where we take a break to thank our patrons on Patreon, and specifically our romantic leads, who are Bob, Esther, Ian, Trey, and Melissa. I want you to want me. And you kind of do, which is great.
Yeah, we don't hate you even a little bit, even at all. If you would like to become a Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/romcomkilljoys, and you can help support us and keep this podcast going, as well as gain access to some behind-the-scenes stuff and get to vote in our monthly polls for what movies we'll cover or topics we'll talk about. So go check that out at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys. And you can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram at romcomkilljoys. We also now have a TikTok, but I'm going to be honest, I don't know how to use it yet. So bear with us.
We're millennials. We're trying.
Well, Janelle, I'm feeling very whelmed right now.
So whelmed.
I don't know if you're going for antidotes, supplements, what have you, but what can you give us?
Oh, supplements. I mean, like I said, nitpicking. I have no notes for this film. I could watch it every day. But so here are my supplements. So on the Shakespeare end of things, not to be a self-promoter, but if you're interested and you want to read my adaptation of Taming of the Shrew, it's called Tame. And you can contact me on Instagram or via email or whatever to read it if you like. It's a very, very dark, much darker adaptation than 10 Things I Hate About You. It's about a lesbian poet named Catherine, who returns home to Texas after her lover passes away, and she strikes up a contentious relationship with her youth pastor, whose name is Patrick. So if you want to read that, let me know. It's a riff. But really, my true supplement I want to recommend, because this movie represents the kind of Riot Girl movement in piece, but not in total, I'm going to recommend the 2013 documentary The Punk Singer, which is about one of my absolute queens, the Riot Girl pioneer Kathleen Hanna, who is very famously the lead singer of Bikini Kill and La Tigra and the Julie Ruin and a bunch of other like amazing music projects that make my heart sing. She and her husband Ad-Rock, aka Adam Horovitz of the Beastie Boys, are such an iconic kind of art and punk rock couple. And the film shows both their kind of love for each other, which doesn't exactly have a Patrick and Kat vibe, but could if you wanted to project onto it. It's a beautiful punk rock love. But really what I love about the film is it shows you the reality, the kind of truth, the political heft behind Riot Girl as a movement. And if we had spent more time with Katarina, what she might have been like. She might have been a little bit more like Kathleen Hanna, which is more complex, you know? It's not simply an angry feminist, but there's a lot more there. So yeah, those are my supplements. My play Tame and the film The Punk Singer.
Definitely, if you get a chance to read Tame, you should. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
All right. Well, on the Shakespeare side of this, I am a musical theater kid. I love musical theater. When I was quite young, I had the opportunity to see a truly excellent Broadway performance that I remember even to this day, although, again, I was quite young when I saw it. And it was of the revival of Kiss Me, Kate.
Yes.
And this revival is from 1999. So if you go onto YouTube and you search Kiss Me, Kate, part 1 out of 22, it will pop up because some brilliant person at some point got a hold of a filmed production of the revival in London, which had gone up on PBS, and they put it all on YouTube, and it has been up there for a number of years and has not been taken down for whatever wonderful reason. So you can go watch Kiss Me, Kate for free right now. Kiss Me, Kate is a musical which is an adaptation of Taming of the Shrew. It is about a divorced couple who are both actors who are performing in a production of Kiss Me, Kate in an attempt to save both of their careers, and are performing as Petruchio and Catherine and fighting on stage and fighting backstage. And the show jumps repeatedly from the like official play within a play on stage performance to the backstage where the entire cast are fighting and falling in love and figuring out their lives and all of this good stuff. And this is a truly wonderful production. It's a lot of fun. The performances are great. But it is one of my favorite adaptations of Taming of the Shrew. And I know there are people who will fight me on that, but whatever, you're wrong. It's wonderful. It's really fun. And one of the things that I think they do really well is that they use a lot of the original Shakespeare text, but they make Catherine so smart. They make her aware at all times, and nothing she says is to be taken at face value. It is all with guile or with sarcasm or with manipulation, and it makes you like the relationship between her and Petruchio so much better. It also has some absolutely phenomenal music and one of just the best musical and dance performances in any Broadway musical, Too Darn Hot, which is just like a true Broadway classic. And if nothing else, go watch a video of Too Darn Hot because it's always fabulous.
Eliza, that is so good. I have to say, like, listen, listeners, you might think you're too cool for a Cole Porter musical. You're not.
You're not.
Kiss Me, Kate is a classic.
On that note, my other supplement is about the fact that we are talking this month about how all of these movies came out in the same year. And so I'm going to recommend a book that is about another year where something similar happened. The book is called Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood. And it is about the five movies which were nominated for Best Picture Oscar in 1967. Those movies were Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, In the Heat of the Night, and one of these things is not like the other, Dr. Doolittle. So the book is about the fact that Dr. Doolittle is this sort of classic, like, hokey, family-friendly, musical-type movie. And then the other four are so new and edgy and different, and they push the boundaries of what film could be and what Hollywood could accomplish. This is coming on the tail end of the, you know, the Hays Code final bits have sort of finally fallen away from Hollywood, and we're moving into what's going to become the radical 70s in Hollywood, where, you know, auteurs appear and directors just take things in such a dark and edgy way. And this year can be pinpointed as sort of the start of that. And so this book is about that and about how these five movies sort of played off each other and what brought each one of them to life and what it meant about the culture that they were happening. And it's a fascinating read, and it's really cool to just think about this, like, one year and what was happening culturally to make all of this happen and where it was going.
Yeah, I guess at some point we're gonna have to talk about why we think 1999 was this flashpoint for all of these movies, huh?
It's just because people were so excited that we were 9 years old, Janelle.
These little 9-year-olds were about to change the world, listeners.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time.
Instead of breaking up, let's start some kissing and making.